Hello. That was a nice introduction there.
Yeah, Cheryl, man, that's pretty good.
It makes you feel like you've been doing the business longer than you have.
Well, you know, what's funny is it says first this movie was Manure and then Stay Cool. It just got me tickled.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, yeah. That's,
smell of success.
The foreign title is Smell Success. The domestic is Manure. They kind of understand Manure here in the United States.
Yeah.
They don't quite understand it abroad.
Well, Mark, we want to thank you for coming on Stana Talk Radio, STR. We're very happy to have you here, and we've been hearing from fans, listeners from around the world, Polish Brother fans, Stana Katic fans, Castle fans, Flow fans. So are you ready for the questions?
Oh, of course.
Are you nervous?
No, for them to give a big thank you to all the fanatics and everybody who loves Stana. They've given me such great support for this film, and I really, really appreciate the love and support. It means a lot.
Are you on the road right now? Are you somewhere?
No,
you know?
I'm stable now. I was on the road. I kind of pulled over and was going to give you all my undivided attention.
All right. So here we go. Now, I'm going to ask you a little bit about your acting career, your early days, and then we'll get into Flow. And then when Cheryl will let me know, we have a lot of people who've been spending the whole night waiting for you to get on here all over the world. So we'll try to get some of them on early so they can then go to bed and then listen in archives tomorrow. So the first thing I'd like to ask you is, what led you to this profession of acting and writing and producing? How old were you when you first started acting?
I acted quite young, but only in, you know, school productions and smaller things that piqued my interest, mainly Wizard of Oz. You know, that was a staple production you did when you were a young kid. Didn't get quite past the wing monkey phase when Mike and I were both wing monkeys. Then went into high school and did a lot of the plays that were, you know, productions there, Our Town, a lot of Shakespeare, a couple musicals that were in there. But struggled with the productions that they were giving us. They weren't very high school kind of production. They were more adult-based. So I started exploring writing at that point, trying to adapt. Hey, this is what teenagers were going through, or what I felt like I wanted to express on stage. So that's where kind of the birth of the writing started, was out of the need to act in contemporary roles. I'd watch Rebel Without a Cause, take it and then adapt it for the stage, and started doing things that I thought, you know, was more relatable to me rather than playing Shakespeare all the time. While I understood it and liked it, it didn't speak to me as much as the contemporary work that I was seeing on either TV or going to the movies or seeing those things and coming back and interpreting for the stage. That's where I first got the bug.
Now, when Rebel Without a Cause, did you play James Dean role?
Of course. Of course.
Or Sal Mineo.
I did play it, but the bigger was East of Eden, because it was a stage play prior. I found stage play material for that. So we actually did almost the full production of that one. So East of Eden, I spoke to a little bit. Great.
So
movie.
James Dean kind of influenced you then, because he was, you know, he was Cal in East of Eden.
Yeah.
I'm a big old movie buff here.
I know. I grew a lot. Although I was born in El Centro, California, I was raised in the Valley of Sacramento. So the Central California was our playground. The Salinas and all those areas that John Steinbeck wrote about was kind of what we could relate to. All like Gilroy and Santa Cruz and all those places.
I know right where you're talking. I'm right here in Hearst Castle is where I live here.
Right.
And
there.
James Dean was killed just 30 miles out of town here.
Yeah, on the 46 right there.
Right. That's right out here.
Right.
So what about on The Wizard of Oz? Did those monkeys scare you to death, really, when you were a kid?
No, they didn't, because I try to bring humanity to them, because I was playing one.
Right.
Humanity to a monkey.
Depending on what your belief is, you know, you never know, they're just a relative.
So when you did you study journalism, and was that in high school or college? Did you attend college, and if so, where?
No, I didn't. You know, the funny thing was that when I during my junior year in high school, I was in an motorcycle accident.
Oh my!
Which prevented me from really working on my portfolio to apply to a couple of the art colleges. So it kind of set me back a little bit. And Michael applied to the school we both want to go to, and he got in, which was California Institute of the Arts, which is up in Valencia here. a little bit north of where Los Angeles, about 25 miles north. It's actually the Walt Disney funded school for animators.
Is that up there by Canyon Country and Magic Mountain?
Yes, it is.
Right.
It's the school Tim Burton came out of.
Newhall.
Yeah, Newhall. And, you know, that whole, I think it's called Santa Clarita now because it
right.
incorporated
it
all the cities. He got accepted, so I followed at 17. I followed it right behind him, and I started to go out and on auditions. And what was funny enough was I didn't understand with the not from no having nobody in the business. I didn't quite understand sides. I'd get a little piece of if anybody's familiar with sides, it's a little piece of the script that you read to audition, which is two or three pages, and the producers or casting directors ask you to read. I wasn't getting a grip on, hey, what's the before of the scene and what's the after? So I'd start requesting the script, and they'd give me whole scripts, and I'd read the whole script and go, wow, you know, being as foolish as I was, I go, well, I think I could write. I think I could. I mean, it looks minimal to me. There's dialogue in the middle, some description up top, not knowing the full act structure or understanding what this whole idea of screenplays were at. So I started to attempt to write around 18, 19 years old, and Michael started picking up a camera, and we just started filming short films at that point. And it was pretty much hands-on learning the craft, just kind of do it yourself. Our father was a very do-it-yourself kind of guy, so we just figured, hey, we have the hands to do it. Let's pick up a camera and start shooting film, and we'll start writing some scenes. To make a long story short, we ended up making a small short sync sound film that started to get a lot of recognition. It was about Mexican boxing, which we're half Mexican and our mother's Mexican, and we used to box on each other's lawns when we were younger, just, you know, the regular copying Rocky type thing. And so we made a film about the kind of neighborhood, the barrios that we'd go into and box, and that started to win quite a few awards among the festival circuit and got us started getting us some attention that, you know, propelled us into writing North Fork, Twin Falls, and voila, you know, we got into Sundance, and that's how it kind of all started at that point. That's an abbreviated version of a pretty rough road.
So pretty much Michael went in first, and then you followed in after you recovered from your motorcycle accident.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Do you have any brothers and sisters besides Michael, or just the two of you?
Yes, we have an older brother that's 2 years older who does photojournalism in the Army.
All right. And so when you look for a script, like, what do you look for in a script? And does the directing begin with the initial read-through when you sit down with your actors and you start to enhance what you're going to do? Do you start directing the actors then with your script as a writer, or is that just mainly the director does that?
We're really close in the sense of the filmmaking team, although Mike's the primary director. We used to co-write everything together, and then we started to branch off and pretty much the primary writer to the things that we do. Every script and every production's a little bit different than, you know, we don't want to repeat the same kind of material. We don't want to repeat the same type of movie. So everything is different. In the case, I'll pick one like Astronaut Farmer. When we finished that, we went right to Billy Bob Thornton, and he read it, and we had a meeting that about 3 days after he read it, and then we started to talk to him about it, but we didn't have to really define the role to him. We kind of wrote it in the sense of that kind of cowboy-esque, very Americana actor, very maverick type guy. We rarely have to rewrite something or do something different for that actor that we go after. We pretty much know who we want, zero in on him, and then go after him. We don't write specifically for an actor as well. We write for the character or the piece in the movie, and then kind of sit down and talk about, well, who do you think can play this role? All
right, so you find the actor later and you get the material.
Yeah.
So what are your major influences when determining what films you will make with the Polish Brothers Production Company? Do you and Mike sit down together and decide this looks like something good, or do you bring him stuff because he's the director and you're the writer, actor?
Yeah, again, everything's a little bit different. Everything we've done up to Big Sur, we've written was our own source material. Mike adapted the Big Sur, the Jack Kerouac novel himself. You know, we get scripts sent to us by other writers quite a bit. We read a lot. I've written a lot of outside material that we don't direct. It's such a different. Almost every year, there's something different going on, and the material that is presented to us outside is usually something that we're interested in, something we probably wouldn't write, or we probably wouldn't come from within us, and so it's more interesting that way. A lot of comic book type stuff that comes to us that we'll either develop or go forward with that we'll do, but mainly what we like to do is sit down and cultivate an idea and write the screenplay ourselves.
So for you as a writer and an actor, mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. are your favorite types of roles to write and act in? Comedy, mm-hmm. drama, adventure, action, or romance?
I like a little bit of both and everything. You know, I like the idea of having, you know, maybe the best way to answer is the movies that I really, really responded to as a kid. I mean, the comedies that I responded to as a kid, if I was to strictly do comedy acting, it's like a Tootsie, which wasn't a based comedy like they do now, where it's tonally a complete comedy. It was more of maybe a dramedy, that kind of thing. Midnight Run was something that you would look at that you liked, that was had a lot of comedy in it, but it was situated in the drama. Those type of things that I really responded to. You know, raised in the 70s in a very hot valley, you watched a lot of cable TV, and at that point in cable TV, they didn't have a lot of programming. So that was kind of our film school. So you'd watch Dog Day Afternoon 8 times in a month. Yeah, and you'd watch Mad Max 7 times in a month. You really got to watch these movies over and over and really study them and really understand that craft, and I attribute, you know, 70s cable to that, HBO, you know, and Cinemax and those things. But going back to the original question of what I look for, or I like the truth in characters, regardless if it's comedy or not. I like the idea that you want to communicate something truthful through your character, whether it's going to make somebody laugh, you still want to base it in honesty, and that's where I always look for when I read a script. As an actor, I look, Is there an honesty in here, regardless if he is a villain or a good guy? What am I trying to communicate to the audience? And can I be that instrument to communicate? I mean, I don't want to take something that I feel that I can't play, you know, in a sense that if you're a musician, you know, there's only so many instruments you can play. And that's what I look for as an actor. Is that something I can do? And if I can I do it well?
Very good. That's excellent. Now, with writing, we'll go into the writing section. Do you feel that when you're what'd you say?
That's just great.
Well, I want to know, when you're writing and you're
yes,
serious emotional scene.
Yes.
Do you find that you guys want to spend more time getting that on film versus, say, an action or like a running chase scene or something? Will you spend more time filming the emotional scenes with the actors' close-ups more so than an action or a physical scene?
Not necessarily. It's usually, you know, you take a scene, whether you're particularly the way you wrote it. And since we are hands-on and we write and we just take what we write to the screen, we take a lot of what to the production or to the set, pretty much edited and knowing what we need immediately. So if it is action, we know the shots that we're going to need. If it's a drama, you know, if you're going to talk about the language of film here, which is coverage, which is usually you start on a wide and then you cover and you go in, you do a two shot and then you do an equally one shot on each person, which is a close up. You know that you're not going to spend the whole scene in a wide establishing shot. So, you know, you're not going to cover it as much as, let's say, an action sequence, which you need a wide to be, make sure that you're going to cover something that, for instance, jumping off a cliff was done in a wide, because you know if you close up, you're going to miss something.
Right.
So, yeah, it's particularly you take each scene and you know, okay, this is how much time I have, this is what I need to cover, and then you can execute it from there.
So when you're writing a script, do you envision the scene in your mind and play it out in your mind before you put it on paper?
Yeah. Pretty much it's coming from that dark spot in your head, through your arms and down through there.
Dark
spot.
So you play out scenes naturally the way you see them. you know, particularly how you would react and what you would do. And since I've done so many films, it's a little bit more of an abbreviated version of, well, you know when you're going to get out. I usually don't write a scene longer than 2 minutes, which is about 2 pages, because you know at that point you're pretty much out of it at that point. So you learn along the way a lot of the tools and the tricks of screenwriting. So you start to apply those a lot more. Go ahead.
Do things just come to you? This is Cheryl. Do things just come to you, and or like you wake up and so, oh, or you're just sitting there and something pops in your head and you go with it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little bit of everything. I mean, you really have to refuel the tank quite a bit, in the sense that it's very solitary work where you're writing. And you want to be able to get out and make sure you see the world the way you see it, and make sure that you file back those moments so you can have those things. Because, you know, the first part of writing, you write about Twin Falls, you're a twin, you understand North Fork. I was raised a little bit in Montana, it was about Danville. You start understanding that. But as you get older, you start, you know, you write what you know. Well, you stop knowing at a certain point. So you got to go start learning things that will help you fuel that tank. You know, there's a regiment that I do where I get up at about 4:30 to 5 and write to about 10. So at that point, your subconscious has a little bit more feet, you know, in the dream world. So it's a nice place to kind of wrestle with and write from that point. That's what usually gets me where my ideas are at, kind of halfway in the dream world, halfway in reality.
What writers have inspired or influenced you to become a writer? Past or present?
Let me see.
But he stands out for you.
I love John Steinbeck. I thought he was an amazing writer. Not Hemingway, you know, always the standards, the big
right.
guys who are really big. Those are the two probably the big. I mean, I would have a list. I like, you know, Harry Cruz. I don't know if you're familiar with Harry Cruz, which is a Florida writer, he's kind of out there. I started to get into him. I liked his work. I haven't read a lot of writers lately. I read a lot of screenplays, so, you know, a lot of movies, I'd have to say, a lot of writers. You know, Sidney Pollack, I wrote, you know, his movies were big.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, a lot of screenwriters that I'd read that I liked a lot.
Cannot believe that he just passed on. He's excellent.
I know, right?
At his movies.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
He just had a wonderful personality, and he also put himself in a lot of movies like Hitchcock did.
Yeah.
And
yes,
I love
yes.
that he'd play parts like in Random Heart and some different
yes.
things like that. So, do you have a philosophy in life that you try to live by?
Appreciate the moment now. I think it's really about living at the moment and not. And always yearning for something more. Always appreciate what's going on at this moment. With, you know, you always tend to always want more than what you have, and you just always kind of ruin what you're doing at the moment. You know, to really, really embrace what's going on at this moment in time, and that's kind of hard to do with the way how fast the world goes and how much stuff is being fed into you, media and just life itself. So it's hard to really enjoy your life at the particular moment, and that's what I try to get up in the morning and try to really focus on, like, how can I win today? You know, what is today that needs to get done, and not really think about tomorrow. And it sounds easy, but it's pretty difficult.
Well, when you had your motorcycle accident, if that was really extremely critical condition or something, I'm sure you reflected on being young as you were there. What am I going to do with my life now? I just about bought it. So
it really stops you, you know, that going at 16 years of age, going as fast as you're living at that point. You know, you're living, you know, as a teenager in the United States, particularly where we were at. In San Francisco, you had Sacramento, you had the cities that you could play in, and it just really halted your life down to, like, you know, you're down bleeding, you know, you're on the pavement, and you got your leg wrapped around, you know, your bike. So, you know, that kind of, like, hey, we're going to stop, and you're going to not be able to do the things that you can't. I was a football player, you can't play football. You're not going to go to the prom. You're not going to do the things everybody around you are going to do. So, yeah, it's a big time of reflection at that moment.
Because you think you're you're invincible.
Yeah, you do. You do at that point. And so, you know, what was great about it is you get to watch a lot of movies. You know?
Well, yeah, and that's what you did.
Yeah.
You watch a lot of Steinbeck,
yeah.
You know, Red
yeah,
Pony
like,
and so forth.
Yeah.
So when you wrote...
I saw a lot of movies.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. When you wrote the character of Eve, did you put a lot of yourself into him, or are you nothing alike? Did I pronounce it right, Eves or Eve?
Yeah, Eve. No, Eve is right.
Eve, okay.
No, I think with every character that I write, yes, you're going to pour your heart into it and understand that character. And I look at it as movies as more of an overall art piece of what you're trying to communicate and how are you going to form these characters between him and Sophia. How are you going to communicate what the ultimate message is? With Eve particularly, you know, you inspired to be that kind of man, which is unconditional love, that you have this undying love for a woman, and it sticks with you. And I think he's the higher self of me in a sense that you'd love to be this guy, even though he has a lot of flaws and he has a lot of issues within himself. He loves this person unconditionally, and I think that's where you inspire to be that person.
So
he was a tremendous character. I mean, I really got into
his mind when you wrote it, especially,
yes.
And then
yes.
As an actor, you try to be him.
So,
and writing the script for Lovers Only, which character did you find the most challenging to write for, and why?
Because
you had your boss, you had Sophia.
Yeah. I think obviously writing. I'm not female, so writing a female's perspective of it. understanding her perspective of the idea of getting the information that she finally receives in the film, and how you would deal with someone you're intensely in love with being married, having a child with somebody else. How would somebody deal with that? And then ultimately, you know, there was a decision to be made in those choices as a screenwriter. Who's going to get that grace at the end? Who's going to have the grace to give it up and say, hey, you know, Eve's going to write a letter, but, you know, she ultimately, and I believe that, you know, since women are the creators, they carry the grace to understand that I am not going to destroy another little girl's life. I am going to give that grace and understand that. And I felt ultimately understanding Sophia in that way, that was probably the most difficult idea to understand, that decision-making process of a girl.
So you're in the part of directing, your twin brother Michael directed the For Lovers Only. And does he think a lot alike like you? Do you guys have the same directing, acting, and writing talents, or is one of you better in one thing than the other?
Yeah, we complement each other, and that's what I think works so well in what we do together, is that we know each other's weaknesses and we know each other's strengths, and we don't try to complicate that situation. I know what he's good at, he knows what I'm good at, and we allow each other to fulfill those roles. I mean, he's a very visual person. He's not very as much as on structure as in writing. He allows me to take that and run with it, and I allow him to do the visuals. And at that point, you know, it's a tremendous amount of respect for one another, and we work very well that way.
Okay. Cheryl, do you have anybody that wants to come on and talk to Mark yet, or we get to go
I have an entirely packed phone lines.
All right.
Oh, dear.
Let's see if some hands are up. I have a lot of questions, but we'll see if we can get some of them in here to talk to him. And is our music composer here yet?
Yes, he is, too.
Yeah, we could bring him on and let him sit with us here, and then when they ask music stuff, we can combine the two, and they can ask Mark, and then how does he pronounce his name?
I've already got it.
Oh, you already asked, Cheryl, because I do not want to. I have a hard time with foreign names, so I want to make sure we don't.
Well, we'll let him say it himself. He's already on here. It's cool.
All right.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And
it's not that hard. It's just Kublai.
Kublai.
But he goes by Kubi. Everybody calls him Kubi.
Kubi. That's easier for me. I'll go with Kubi.
Yeah.
No, that's easier. That's a lot easier. So welcome to Stana Talk Radio. We're going to start taking questions. We have some questions for you a little bit later on in the show, but we thought we'd bring you on so you could be here with Mark and hear what the fans have to say about For Lovers Only, because a lot of them enjoy the music, of course. So, Cheryl, I almost called you Stana. Cheryl, can you... Can
wow.
you bring on somebody here? Because I know yes. we have a lot of people calling from India and all over.
That's the first one up.
Bring them on.
Who called in actually first. It's Nadu, who MB the Cool. She
Nice.
Is, I'm sure, one of your largest fans, Mark. So, Madhu, you're
oh,
on.
Yeah.
Hello, Mark. How are you? Can you hear me?
Hey. Hi, sweetheart. How are you? I speak to her quite a bit on Twitter and otherwise.
Yeah. Thank you for being so kind and tolerate me for the last 4 months. Yeah, you are an amazing person. I really admire you a lot.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
I appreciate that. I mean, yes.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions for you. You and Mike told somewhere in some interview that you want to do a film where you will direct the movie Half and Half.
Yes.
Well, will we see that coming in the near future? Like you
yeah,
direct a movie Half and Half?
Yeah, I mean, there was an idea that we've always had that we thought would be a very interesting, you know, exploration of a twinship, which we would each do about 45 minutes of, or maybe more, about 60, whatever it turns out to be a feature, about two twins separated at birth. We'd direct each one, act each, and then see, and not read each other's screenplay, and then see where that takes us, and see if we kind of, you know, there's a great study about twins that have been separated to see how they live, and they've married this very similar woman, they've done very similar occupations, and see if that works. So, it's experimental in the sense that, you know, I don't think there's a lot of financiers who want to experiment that way, but we find it an intriguing idea to see, to explore that kind of twinship and see if it can come out in a film. So that's something we've
direct commercials, so it will be great to see you directing a movie.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And did you think of an alternate ending for For Lovers Only? Because lots of movies release with alternate endings. And assuming that you didn't run out of ink, why was the last scene in color instead of black and white?
Oh, you get to ask that question. I mean, I know that is that is one of these questions that has been buzzing around. And first and foremost, the last scene being in color, I'm not going to give our reason behind it. It's up for interpretation, which I know is not going to make a lot of people happy.
I know why.
You will keep us guessing.
I mean,
do you know that lots of Bollywood movies, the old Bollywood movies had like the whole movie was in black and white and one odd scene was like in color. So when I saw that last scene, I found a little touch of Bollywood. Maybe you unknowingly you put that in, but that was a touch of Bollywood, really.
Oh, great.
Or like
that's
a dream
a
sequence or something. But
yeah,
as you guys were talking
yeah.
about half and half and twins, I have six sets
yeah.
of twins in our family.
We have six as well.
Yeah, and so they jump generations, and we have paternal and ones who are not identical. And so it's very interesting how they think and act and who they marry. So that'll be interesting to see when you bring that about.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Do you have any more questions
Just one more question. I know, Mark, you are a big fan of Mad Max Trilogy, and you are a big fan of Meryl Streep. So if you had, opportunity to do a dream casting, who would you cast in that movie for actress? Meryl Streep?
Meryl Streep, Paul Newman, maybe a younger Mel Gibson, not the one we know now, but not that I don't like him now. It's just that he was such a great actor when he was younger. I like those two.
So was Paul Newman.
Paul Newman.
And you love Al Pacino, like me.
I love Al Pacino. I love Robert De Niro.
Yeah,
you know, those guys are...
We go all the time fangirling and fanboying over Al Pacino and Meryl Streep.
Okay, so afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, a lot of lovers are in the queue, so I'm going to hang up. Love you, Mark. See you later.
Thank you.
Thank
love you,
cool
too.
One.
Bye.
Bye.
Next,
next
we
show.
Have Susan. from Utah. Susan, there you're on the air with Mark and Kubi.
Kubi.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Great, really good.
Susan,
great
you there?
To talk to you. Yes,
oh,
I'm
okay,
here. Can you hear me?
I can hear. Yeah, I can hear you now better. Okay. Go for it.
Okay. First of all, I want to say thank you for Lovers Only. Watching it was such a joy. I expected it to be great. I just didn't expect to be just completely moved by this movie, but it was brilliant.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate it. It means a lot to Michael and I, and I think all the creators, even Kubi and Stana as well. I mean, we really went out there and tried to do something from our heart, and it seems to have connected with people, and it really means a lot.
Now, I'm curious, at the end where Eve leaves the note for Sophia with the bitten
mm-hmm.
apple, does that bitten apple have significance?
His name is Eve, isn't it?
That's what I thought.
Forbidden fruit?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there is a layer of symbolism in there, and there's a lot of subtext in there as well. And that is something that I love to do as a writer and put in there. And as always with symbolism, you know, there's my interpretation of what the symbol means, and there's always I love to hear other people's versions of what's going on. But, yeah, the bitten apple, I mean, it goes all the way from biblical times all the way to Macintosh. So it's something that is a very, very heavy symbol, and I wanted to put something there that Eve left to say to her.
Well, I thought it was really great, and I loved the religious undertones that you had in the film. You know, when she said, "Where are we going?" and he said, "We're going to hell." And you know, from the beginning, they knew what they were doing was wrong, but it felt so right, and so they.
Yeah.
It was just, and you know, when Eve said the line, "The boss's son," I'm like, "What did he just say?"
Yeah.
I had to back it up and listen. I'm like, "Oh, okay, I get it."
Yeah. You know, the thing is I was raised Catholic. You know, did all the catechism, did all the things that you do growing up Catholic, and it's very much a part of my life. And especially throughout Europe and stuff, their culture and the churches and the prominence of religion is so heavy, and it's so much a part of the culture. Unlike the United States, where you do see churches, but nothing as grand or as beautiful as they do in Europe. And I wanted that to always overshadow them in some sense, and always be present in what they're doing. And it was important that they were aware of what they were doing, although it was it's not looked upon as favorable. A lot of people, I wanted it to be in the subconscious and always percolating on what they were doing.
Great.
Well, I thought it was great. And, you know, where they ended
Thank
up,
you.
Where she ended up in the church and
mm-hmm.
she had the line, you know, we need a miracle. You know, she wanted the hand of God to come in and help her in this situation. It was just so desperate and, you know, heartbreaking. You could just tell she just wanted something to happen to make it be okay.
You know, funny enough, when we filmed that scene, it was probably a 3-minute scene with a tremendous amount of dialogue between them. And as we filming it, it weighed down that point. And the way she just delivered, "We need a miracle," was at the end of her dialogue at that point. And that's all we needed at that point. And when you saw it as we were cutting the film, we pretty much cut those 2 pages of dialogue out and let the scene hang on that particular line because it was so powerful.
Right.
Well, brilliant. I just wanted to say to Kubi real quick, I love, love, love your score.
Thank you so much.
Yes, it's so beautiful and brings me to tears when I watch the film. I love the music that plays when they have their first kiss all the way to the end where Sophia's tear runs down her face is just brilliant.
Thank you so much.
And then I also love the score at the end where they're in the field. That's so beautiful. And to me, that music made me feel like, okay, it's a happy ending. Even though they're not together, it's meant to be happy, that it's a happy ending. And it felt so good. I love listening to it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we can talk a little bit since she's touched on the score. And I mean, me and Kubi can fill in that we really worked hard on it. I mean, it was a score that could go bad quickly, and in the sense that you're dealing with black and white, and there's not a lot of room for error. And you can correct me if I'm wrong on that, Kubi.
No, absolutely. It was. It took a while to figure out how to approach it, but then I felt like once we knew where we were going, it was. It was. I don't want to say it was easy, but it was clear.
Yeah.
That way.
Yeah. It was clear.
I'm
beautiful
curious.
Music.
What was the first piece of music that was composed for the film?
When they're in the bathtub and he finds the tattoo.
Okay.
That was, and I just picked that because it felt like I like to pick a scene that encompasses in a fairly short time a lot of the basic feel of the movie without having too many twists and turns, because
okay.
It's a good spot to sort of develop how are we going to, what's this movie going to sound like. And so I ended up just picking that scene and writing a whole lot of music to that scene, and ended up being four completely different sketches, and the fourth one is the basis of what you heard.
That's beautiful.
Wow. Thank you very much. Yeah, I loved it's my pride and joy. I love that. I love the film, and I love the music for it. I'm very happy.
Well, it certainly is another character in the film.
Yeah.
The longer I write music for film, the more I think of it as acting in notes. It's really, the longer I do it, the more I realize that it really is, it is like a character that you write that interacts with every piece of the story. And this, when I realized that, I feel my writing got a lot better.
Well, not only is the music a character, but the scenery, the location.
Oh, yeah.
And in saying that, Mark, I know that Stana recently interviewed you for her new